The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
From WABE in Atlanta, this is a special Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Today marks 55 years when the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee.
Well, I think only maybe after Gandhi he's seen as the leading proponent of nonviolent civil disobedience, which he used, as Gandhi did, against the British. He used it very effectively from the time the bus boycotts and the sit-ins and lunch counters.
We'll explore a lot of these reflections on this hour of Closer Look. And also, we'll examine a podcast from The Atlantic called Holy Week, which explores what's considered one of America's most fiery and contentious weeks in U.S. history between King's assassination and funeral here in Atlanta.
There were those who never believed in nonviolence because they never understood the depth of that method of solving problems in the world. Dr. King was by far the most articulate spokesman on earth in that regards, and to some extent, Dr. King has been a buffer the last few years between the black community and the white community. White people do not know it, but the white people's best friend is dead.
That's coming up in just a moment on this special edition of Closer Look. And today's remembrance of King's assassination will be marked by moments of reflection and a discussion for economic action. The King Center will host three wreath-laying ceremonies today, one at King's Tomb and two more, plus a candlelight vigil at Ebenezer Baptist Church. Already this afternoon, the King Center and the National Civil Rights Museum hosted a virtual conversation featuring Dr. Bernice King, Dr. Russ Wigginton of the Civil Rights Museum at the Lorraine Motel. The theme of the discussion, transforming unjust economic systems. And earlier today, WABE General Assignment Reporter Julian Virgin spoke with visitors at the King Center who offered their own reflections about Dr. King and his longstanding vision.
How are you on a daily basis going about just taking what Martin Luther King did and what he stood by and just moving it forward in your life?
Really just recognizing everybody. I'm fortunate enough to be a firefighter, and you know, you treat everybody the same no matter what their situation is. You know, I grew up very fortunate and was lucky. There's, you know, nothing that made me any more special than anybody else. And just realizing that.
We weren't exposed to it growing up on the northwest coast of our country. And I appreciate coming down here and learning so much about all that took place while we were kids.
Yeah, we lived through that. We were young adults and youth.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I do, I vote. I make sure I vote. And also exposing, I'm an educator, so what I do is expose our students to real world experiences. And in the unit that they're about to have, civil rights, this is one of the ways that I make the change, letting them see the past and how it affects the things that they do now.
And that is WABE General Assignment Reporter Julian Virgin speaking with Kenya Hurd, Joan Wistie, and Brian Duffy. And you can hear more later today from WABE News during All Things Considered, hosted by Jim Burris. When we come back, Atlanta's beloved son, Dr. King, is silenced as we examine the days before and after April 4th. You're listening to Closer Look.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cf.org. GreaterAtlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
And Closer Look continues now. From WABE in Atlanta, I'm Rose Scott. On this day, 55 years ago, the world lost a scholar, Baptist minister, husband, civil rights titan, father. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee, shot just after 6 p.m. while standing on the second floor balcony of the Lorraine Motel. King was pronounced dead at 7:05 p.m. at St. Joseph Hospital. He was 39 years old. Although known for being an ambassador of nonviolence, his death, yes, sparked outrage. And what we know is that history suggests that nearly 200 cities experienced a lot of outrage. Protests following King's death. It's estimated that around 3,500 people were injured, 43 were killed, and 2,700 people were arrested. The week that followed King's death is also Holy Week, and it's now the focus of a new podcast, Holy Week, The Story of a Revolution Undone.
Do you think that this will have any dramatic effect on the relations between the white and black in this community?
Well, obviously it will. There were those who never believed in nonviolence because they never understood the depth of that method of solving problems in the world. Dr. King was by far the most articulate spokesman on earth in that regards, and to some extent, Dr. King has been a buffer the last few years between the black community and the white community. White people do not know it, but the white people's best friend is dead.
The podcast is hosted by The Atlantic's senior editor, Van Newkirk II, and as he did back in 2018, he joined us for our ATL 68 series, and he joins me now to talk more about the podcast and the research and reporting that went into putting the 8-episode audio story together. Van, welcome back. Good to see you. Good to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Let's begin here, because on this day, every year, people offer a lot of reflection. People offer up comparisons to then and to now. So the question I'm about to ask you is nothing new, but we reflect on 55 years since the assassination of Dr. King, and how do you offer up through your own lens, you know, where we are as a society in terms of Dr. King's message?
Yeah, I think 55 is a good number to do that, because it gives us a time when, obviously a half century has passed, you've had multiple generations who've grown into the America that King left. I think we look at the picture of things King fought for, things like voting rights, things like integration. Obviously, black folks can vote now. You can go to a state school or a private school of your choice. There have been serious gains in education, in economics, in household economics. I think there's also, as any reasonable person would admit, there's plenty left on the table to do. A lot of those gains in wealth, they've stagnated. A lot of the gains in integration have reversed. And we see voting rights and things like that uniquely under threat in the last few elections. So I think I would say we are at a moment of somewhat crisis, or at least thinking about what those values, what those accomplishments, what that stride toward equality means, and how much people are willing to fight to preserve it.
Now, Van, you are a Morehouse man, so it is not lost on you the legacy of Dr. King. But when you think about this generation that we're in, I think the youngest generation, we call them Z. And even look for some of the old folks like me from Generation X, you know, who are in between, you know, right on the born, you know, at the end of what we say the civil rights movement. And then you look at the Z, and is there a disconnect, you think, in for them to understand? They know the significance of it. I'm not going to say they don't. I'm not going to paint the whole group like that. But in terms of how young activists now, what their process is for activism and protests, how would you sum that up?
Well, I think number one, I've got two kids who are 6 and 3. So I think about this a lot, just, you know, sort of what our duty as adults is to shepherd that history and make sure they know it. And what I'll say about, I think, Gen Z folks who are entering adulthood now, who are building their lives now, a lot of them, obviously, it's they're more distant from the history. Mm-hmm. There's just more time in between. And our schools, you see what's happening with sort of on the educational front, what's being allowed in schools and what's not being allowed in schools. Mm-hmm. And I think they're an interesting crossroads. On the one hand, you have more projects that are doing critical thinking about civil rights that they're absorbing. You've got people who are taking up the mantle of organizations like SNCC, who are seeing in their activism echoes of folks like Ella Baker. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I think you do have a lot of people who are missing critical context, who aren't exposed to the experiences of their elders in a way that would have been sort of normal and natural for mm-hmm. me or you. And so I think it's all of our job as people who are close to the history, who are able to go and interview people who were there, to make sure that we bring it to them in as an accessible way as possible.
You know, there have been obviously so many books, documentaries, movies written, display, talking about what we call the Holy Week uprisings. Two questions for you all. What led you all at the Atlantic to tackle this? And in what way will this podcast be different and maybe offer some different insights into what happened after Dr. King's assassination?
Well, our leading thesis was there isn't a whole lot of media actually dedicated to this moment and looking at it and sitting with it and understanding both the moment of the assassination and that week of uprisings that happened after. It's not really a major focus of major civil rights documentaries. It's actually something that kind of sits uncomfortably with the school book version of King, where most of what you hear is from Montgomery to Selma, right? So mm-hmm. you get late 50s, you get 60s, you get 65, the Voting Rights Act, and there's not a whole lot to say about King in the late 60s and what he was doing in Memphis when he was killed. So for me, this is a time that is pivotal for understanding America today that doesn't get the same glossy big project treatment. And mm-hmm. what I hope that we were able to do with this podcast is to both show people how pivotal that moment was, but also sit and contemplate why it's been so difficult to hold in our memories and to hold critically in our memories. And I think part of that is just sheer grief of the mm-hmm. thing, trauma, people trying to leave that. But also I think part of it is if you sit and really think about what King was doing, about how he was received in America while he was doing it at that time, it is inconvenient to the dominant narrative of what civil rights is and what it did in America.
It was a tough time for Dr. King. Many within his inner circle, because I've spoken with him, I'm sure you have too, talk about, you know, if he were to have an approval rating, they did one back then, it would not have been very favorable. There were calls for perhaps there should be a different type of response to what was happening to Black folks in this country. I want to play a clip from you all are sharing with John Burrow Smith, one of the last people to meet with King at the Lorraine Motel just hours before he was assassinated.
Black power would have been able to show that we could work with Dr. King, we could work with nonviolence, and we could actually be nonviolent, but we were definitely not going to be submissive and passive.
John never got to see that America. Nobody did. The next day, the nation would lay King to rest. All the talk in the movement and in Washington was how they would keep his dream alive, how they could still overcome. But John worried that the dream might be buried with the man.
What will listeners, I don't want to give too much away, but what will listeners learn from this part of the podcast about what was happening?
Yeah, John was a member of the Memphis Invaders, the person you're speaking, and he, that group was a local Black Power group in Memphis who, when King came to Memphis, was sort of clashing with him. They disagreed with his nonviolent tactics. They wanted a more confrontational stand in favor of those Memphis sanitation workers. And I think what you'll hear is, through John's story, how they came to actually see what King believed and themselves begin to be changed by it.
You all spoke to some folks, some familiar names, at least last names. Give some insight for our listeners who they'll hear throughout this podcast, some names they might recognize.
Yeah, so I think if you are keeping up, as a lot of people are, with the story of the King family, we spoke to Wandalyn Abernathy, mm-hmm. who is the daughter of Ralph David Abernathy. We really dwelled on sort of that immediate time, how her family dealt with the loss of King, how her father dealt with the loss of King. We spoke to a couple other people in the movement as well. We spoke to Frank Smith, mm-hmm. also went to Morehouse. He was a founding member of SNCC, of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And he was in D.C. As an activist when King was killed. We also spoke to people in the highest rungs of power in America. So we spoke to Joe Califano, who was President Lyndon B. Johnson's top domestic advisor at the mm-hmm. time, a couple of the staff in the White House. So I think what we tried to do was to get a look at every single level of power and of reaction in America at the same time.
Do you all explore why Atlanta was not one of the cities that had a major uprising and why?
Yeah, we really, it was interesting looking at Atlanta, looking at Memphis as well. So I think there's similar things happening in both cities. So they are obviously the two focal points of the King family, of the nucleus of the nonviolent movement in the immediate days after King's assassinated. I think that actually explains a lot of it. You've got two cities that are so incredibly and intensely focused on how to just what to do, mm-hmm. on what to do with King the man, how to honor him, what to do with his body. You know, like people lining up to go to vigils, people going to see him. And I think people sort of, his legacy was so strong. And so just people didn't want to go out. They didn't want to go out to the streets. They were trying to figure out where to go to line up to be to go see the funeral, which was at the time was maybe the largest, most viewed funeral in American history. Mm-hmm. And so I think you could see the presence of King sort of was still in those two cities, especially Atlanta. Mm-hmm. My favorite story, Atlanta, is actually right after King was killed, the White House had to come up with what their response was going to be. And one thing that might seem inconsequential is they ordered every single state to lower their flag to half mast for King. And that forced the then segregationist governor of Georgia to actually lower the flags at the state capitol and around the state.
Yeah, Lester Maddox was not someone who was that wanted to do that. Let's be really clear.
He had to honor King. Yeah.
Yeah. You and I, storytellers and researchers, and I know how much time it goes into putting something like this together. Do you concern yourself with what you hope listeners take away from this 8-episode podcast? Or you look, this is the information. Here it is. You all do what you want with it.
I'm always interested in what people take away from the story. And I mean, I think to the best of my ability, I present it in a way that is going to be absorbed, or at least the information I think is important is going to be absorbed. I said before, I have children, and this is that's the most important thing to me. This podcast is free. It's hopefully a resource for young folks, especially now that lots of Black history won't be in textbooks in certain places, including my own home. So I think just the ability to go and listen to your elders, to understand and hear their experiences, that to me is the primary piece of it, which is why it's so important that we talk to people who are on the streets, who are in the riots, who are in Black communities. I don't think it's possible to overstate how important it is just to hear those voices. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, I think people should really be thinking about what Julian Bond called the master narrative in America. They should be thinking about what story we are told about the civil rights movement, how we believe it affected America, how we believe America responded to it, and then sit and actually look at their material conditions and see what the discrepancies are. That's what I hope people take away from.
Absolutely. That is a perfect way to end our conversation. Van Newkirk II, The Atlantic's senior editor and host of the podcast, Holy Week, The Story of a Revolution Undone. As always, Van, you hit it out the park. Thank you so much for taking the time, brother. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Says, I understand in each of us, whenever we observe injustice, there is something that calls, that triggers an indignation and outrage. It's okay to feel angry. But I choose to channel that anger and indignation into the posture of a disciplined restraint and a commitment to never dehumanizing my opponent. He said, don't even call them enemies. They are opponents, and we must never dehumanize them.
If you look at King as a whole person, right, and that's really what we're teaching, looking at people as whole individuals, not as flat characters, but as whole individuals, good and bad and what have you, you know that he was radical.
King, at his very core, led a movement that tried to, even at times where it was disobeying laws that were unjust, maintain its own morality, and then eventually allow reconciliation to happen. Because King wasn't just about justice, but eventually he was about reconciliation.
The things that Maynard and Martin Luther King shared were things like they both believed in nonviolence. Both of them were transformative figures. Dr. King was transformative in his civil rights approach, using the tactics of nonviolence and civil disobedience.
Some very sad news for all of you, and that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis.
The American tragedy of Martin Luther King's murder has brought an outpouring of universal reaction. Pope Paul VI urged calm and respect for the principle of brotherly love. Great Britain's Parliament expressed horror at what it termed this brutal and senseless murder. In Africa, where King was a hero, his assassination brought praise for the man from statesmen and predictions of widespread violence in America's cities. UN Secretary General U Thant, now in Geneva, sent a message of sympathy to Mrs. King. A similar message went to the bereaved widow from Sweden's King Gustav, who presented the Nobel Peace Prize to the civil rights leader back in the year 1964.
Good evening. Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. Police have issued an all-points bulletin for a well-dressed young white man seen running from the scene. Officers also reportedly chased and fired on a radio-equipped car containing two white men. Dr. King was standing on the balcony of a second-floor hotel room tonight when, according to a companion, a shot was fired from across the street. In the friend's words, the bullet exploded in his face. Police, who have been keeping a close watch over the Nobel Peace Prize winner because of Memphis' turbulent racial situation, were on the scene almost immediately. They rushed the 39-year-old Negro leader to a hospital where he died of a bullet wound in the neck. In a nationwide television address, President Johnson expressed the nation's shock.
America is shocked and saddened by the brutal slaying tonight of Dr. Martin Luther King. I ask every citizen to reject the blind violence that has struck Dr. King, who lived by nonviolence.
Dr. King had returned to Memphis only yesterday, determined to prove that he could lead a peaceful mass march in support of striking sanitation workers, most of whom are Negroes. Dr. King had this to say last night about the situation in Memphis.
Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest for right.
And voices from 1968 to the present. This is a special edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Today, marking 55 years when the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. And we heard from Emory's Dr. Robert Franklin, Emory Professor Nsinga Burton, Doug Shipman, Valerie Jackson, and archival news footage from CBS News with Walter Conkright. Dr. King was in Memphis as sanitation workers began a strike. The reason? Years of extremely low wages and unsafe working conditions. Two workers had died after being crushed by a garbage compactor. 1,300 men walked off the job. Marches and meetings would occur daily. The workers would carry or wear signs that read, "I am a man." And garbage began to pile up, and violent clashes also ensued. This would lead Dr. King and others to Memphis. And actually, Dr. King came back for a second visit regarding the strike. And Dr. King led a protest march back on March 28th of that year. He would return to Memphis on April 3rd. Expecting another violent clash and to prevent Dr. King's involvement, the city went through a federal judge to actually try and issue an injunction blocking King's participation. And this is where a team of lawyers would be needed. One of those attorneys was a very young W.J. Michael Cody. He was asked to represent Dr. King. I spoke with Mr. Cody at Emory University's law school back in 2018. Then, at the age of 81, he recalled why King needed legal help. And, of course, King's legacy.
Can you even put into words what it's been like these last five decades since the assassination of Dr. King and what his impact, his legacy has been, not just on Atlanta, obviously, not just on the civil rights movement, and not just to the United States, but to the world?
Well, I think only maybe after Gandhi he's seen as the leading proponent of nonviolent civil disobedience, which he used, as Gandhi did, against the British. He used it very effectively from the time the bus boycotts and the sit-ins and lunch counters. And he revolutionized and changed the laws throughout the country to allow better access to facilities and to things that were needed. And I think he was probably one of the most articulate. His two speeches that most people remember, the "I Have a Dream" speech, sort of can't be matched. And the last speech, which I heard, which was called the Mountaintop Speech, was eloquent itself. And I think it was his eloquence and his ability to inspire people and to get them to make sacrifices to improve the lives of other people that he'll always be remembered for. And there were a lot of other white and black leaders, but he was the one that seemed to have the moral integrity that people could respect and could sacrifice for.
In all of your 82 years and all of your career, no 2 days have been like April 3rd and April 4th.
Well, that's probably true in terms of the highlight of the activity of those 2 days. Of course, until Dr. King was killed on the evening of April 4, we didn't know that it was going to be that significant a 2 days. The ACLU called us to get involved, and we thought it was just another civil rights case and had no idea that it would end up with him making a speech that seemed to have a premonition that led to his death the next day.
The story of Mel Wolf from the ACLU calling you and asking you to represent Dr. King, and immediately you say yes, but then there's this moment where you're like, well, wait, I'm going to represent Dr. King.
And that would have been the mid-morning of April the 3rd, just after the city had obtained an injunction and the ACLU did not want Dr. King to march in the face of a federal injunction. And Mel Wolf and Chuck Morgan, who at that time was the Southern director here in Atlanta, called me on the phone, and it was I wasn't a big prize. I was just the only lawyer they knew in Memphis because I had been the local chairman of the ACLU and I was on the national board in New York. And I don't think they ever really thought I was going to do all the significant work, but I had a man in my office who was really the best trial lawyer in Memphis and had devoted much of his life to civil rights work. And so I immediately knew that we needed him to be the lawyer, and I'd carry his books or whatever else happened.
Because you didn't have much experience as a civil rights attorney. You'd just been a lawyer, what, maybe 5-6 years?
Yes, that's right. I'd actually watched some of civil rights work of John Doerr with the Justice Department in Memphis and the summer of 1960, and then when I came to work in 1961, fairly soon I became involved with the ACLU. So from about 62 to 68, I had been involved in cases, the Freedom Summers, people going to Mississippi to register people to vote. I assisted in that. We had a lot of youngsters often that would demonstrate protest things, the schools still being segregated, and they would get expelled, and we would represent them. I worked with Mr. Birch to integrate the parks and the department stores and movie theaters and things like that. You can't imagine, even as recently as 1961, if you went to the zoo in Memphis on Thursday, there'd be a big sign that said, "No whites allowed," which meant, of course, that every other day of the week, no blacks were allowed. And when we were working with the department stores to try to get jobs for African Americans, a black woman, for instance, could shop at a big department store in Memphis, but wasn't able to try on a hat or a dress. And those injustices existed well into the 60s. So there's a lot of civil rights work being done. And then the sanitation strike came in the spring of 68.
That is W.J. Cody, one of Dr. King's lawyers. Conversation we had back in 2018 on the campus of Emory University. Then at the age of 81, he was recalling why Dr. King needed legal help in Memphis and King's legacy. You can hear this entire interview in full by visiting mlk.wabe.org. That's mlk.wabe.org from our award-winning series, ATL 68. This is Closer Look, and we're back in a moment. ¶¶
Martin Luther King, the beautiful thing that I thought about today was the fact that he understood the necessity to cultivate and refine a sense of value in the individual, because we've been torn down so deeply and over time, that he understood that once you start there with the individual, you have to cultivate yourself. You have to care for yourself. He understood that. So his interaction with the poor, and particularly with Black working class folk, was always to imbue in them a certain value. You are valuable. You can be Black and beautiful. I think that was fundamental. You have to begin with, how do you feel about yourself such that you care for yourself, which leads you to care. His assumption, I think, is accurate. You care for others. And then to a more transcendent relationship, he calls it God. But the idea is that you cultivate sense of self, understand you're not in the world alone. And then what's going to be the guiding principle that allows for this social arrangement to maintain itself at the highest level of respect, care, love, and dignity? And that's what I believe his great value was. He always understood we have been broken down to the point where we have to have it.
And that is Professor Ilya Davis from the Morehouse College. You're listening to a special edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. As we continue with special programming today, talking about 55 years ago today, when Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in Memphis. Among so many people, obviously, who remember that day clearly, and the days that followed, well, Shanona Clayton, trailblazing journalist, friend, and aide to the King family, and civil rights activist in her own right. So recently, when we had a conversation, we recalled when she first heard the news of King's death. You were meeting with someone, a representative of the KKK.
Yes.
The night that you heard that, you got a phone call. You were at a restaurant, I do believe. Someone came over and said, "Ms. Clayton, there's a call." And
yeah.
I'll let you take it from here, because that was the night.
Yeah. We were having a dinner, and the maitre d' at the restaurant knew I was here because of the King, so they knew my relationship. And she came over with a little note, said, "Did you hear about Dr. King?" Now, I had driven him to the airport to go to Memphis, as you have already mentioned. And he called me that afternoon, like 3 o'clock our time. And he said, "Why does my room number sound so familiar to him?" I said, "I don't know, because I read in the paper you don't switch hotels, so I don't even know where you are." And he said, "Well, my room number is 305. And I said, "Well, that happens to be my address, and you've been in my home so many times, so maybe you just, you know, recognize the familiarity in the room." But he said, "I finally called my mother, and I had asked him to do his mother, ask him, because that Sunday, which was 2 days before this now, because I think it was Tuesday, we had just a wonderful time. We had dinner together. I was at their home, and we had dinner, and then we went to the piano. He said, "I bet you didn't know I could sing." I said, "Well, I heard you could, but I don't know whether you really can or not." And he said, "Well, get on the piano and give me a B-flat." And so he knew I played the piano, so I gave him a B-flat, and he started singing. I said, "Oh, it sounds pretty good, you know." And so in the car going to the airport, I talked about his mother calling and said we had so much fun that Sunday afternoon, that she wishes that we could have more family moments like that. Mm-hmm. So tell him to change his schedule sometimes and include, you know, family gatherings. So I told him what she said. As it turned out, I didn't know until later, you know, about when we found he'd been shot. Mrs. King wanted me to go over to their house to see that they were okay. She was concerned about Mom and Dad, mm-hmm. And she was crying. But she said, "I will be eternally grateful to you because he called me today." Mm-hmm. And so she said it was about 3 o'clock Atlanta time. And so by that, she thinks, according to the time, mm-hmm. that might have been his last call. Right. And so she just believe that she got the last call from him because he was shot right after that.
Mm-hmm. After Dr. King was assassinated, what was the conversation about within the inner circle for you all in terms of still getting the movement, still working with the movement, and at the same time, y'all are grieving the loss of your friend. How did you all get through that?
Well, at that time, the Memphis garbage workers strike kind of had taken over the headlines. And so Mrs. King said right away, I'm going to go. So emphasis shifted real quickly just to the garbage strikers. I can't remember what, the march had taken place, but it had been successful. The march on Washington had been very successful, to the tune that President Johnson invited all of the civil rights workers to the White House to let them know that nothing happened in the city, the district of Washington, D.C., that in all of its environs, there were no arrests. Nobody tearing down the city. And the president felt like maybe that was a good cause because he had objected to it initially when they brought him the idea. He and Dr. King had a very good relationship. And Dr. King had told the president about the march, and he tried to advise him not to do it because it's going to just be so turbulent. And he was so pleased when nothing happened bad. It was everybody left singing, getting in the buses, going home, and it was a joyful afternoon.
Hear my cry.
Actually, Mahalia Jackson singing at Dr. King's funeral. Now, shortly after his death, Dr. King's body was brought to Spelman College, and people from all around the world came to pay their respects. There was a woman who played the organ for those visitors. Well, she's former Spelman professor, Dr. Joyce Johnson. Now, I spoke with Johnson, yes, for our ATL 68 series, to reflect on the day that King died and how it affected the Spelman campus. And there's something else. On the day of April 4th, 1968, Johnson and her husband were celebrating their anniversary.
That night of April the 4th, my husband and I were attending an Atlanta Symphony Orchestra concert in celebration of our anniversary, which is April the 4th. And we had a babysitter with our daughter, Joya. And when we arrived back at home, the babysitter told us, as soon as we entered the house, that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had been assassinated in Memphis. It was unbelievable. We just, unbelievable, and of course, very painful at that time.
That next day, you came to Spelman, you came to work. What was the, it may seem like a silly question, what was the mood of the institution? Take your time.
Of course, I guess it was just pandemonium everywhere. Everyone was upset and concerned. There was anger, there was sadness. All kinds of emotions were being expressed on campus. I guess maybe it was, I don't remember exactly when his body was coming to the campus, but I think it was Mrs. King, Coretta Scott King, arranged with the college minister at that time, Reverend Rates, for his body to come to the campus. And of course, that's I'm sure that's because There are so many generations of King family members who had attended Spelman College. Dr. King's maternal grandmother, his mother, his sister. So it was just very appropriate for his body to be here at Spelman.
Did you make the decision, or were you asked to play for those 2 days?
I was asked to play for those 2 days by the college minister here, who was fulfilling the request of Mrs. King. And I was asked because I was the college organist at that time. I have been the college organist since 1955.
I've been hearing this story. You played for 2 days. How long did you play each day? And did you have a piece picked out? Can you take me through your process of preparing?
Well, to put the record straight, I did not play nonstop for 2 days or more, but I did play, and my husband did remind me that I did play through the night, the first night into the next day. I did play long periods of time and through the next day. I think for the next night, Reverend Rates thought it would be a good idea to play recorded music rather than have me stay a second night and play overnight. So in terms of choosing music, it was not difficult to choose quiet, reflective music, some of which may have been spirituals. Also, some of the music was improvisatory in the character necessary for this kind of event.
Were you emotional?
Absolutely, I was. And yes, absolutely.
Dr. Johnson, I would really, and you don't have to, but would you play something for us that you played?
I'll be happy to play for you. I think at that time I did not know that one of Dr. King's favorite pieces was Precious Lord, Take My Hand. So I don't know whether I played that or not, but I'll play.
When you reflect not just on that time, but 50 years since his death and the achievements, the progression, many say challenges that still remain, what are your thoughts on 50 years since his death? And
that's a difficult question because, as the old saying goes, the more things change, the more they stay the same. And sometimes it's very difficult to really access the progress that has been made in these 50 years. A segment of our population has reaped benefits of the civil rights movement and laws that were enacted afterwards, perhaps. But a large segment of our population still is in need of better education, better health care, better respect, better protection from the police, increased opportunities for their personal growth. So it's just a big question. I think we have to give a lot of credit to our historically black institutions, which increasingly provide a very high quality of education for the students who are able to come to these institutions. However, these institutions are limited to a great extent also because of finances, but we have to salute them for the great efforts that are being made and the progress that is being made. The more things change, the more they stay the same, especially when we get incompetent people in high places. So I don't know what else to say about that.
Dr. Joyce Johnson, Professor Emerita of Spelman College, thank you for taking the time. Thank you for sharing. Thank you for reflecting. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. My pleasure to know you and to express my appreciation to you for all of the excellent work that you do for our community and our world.
From 2018, my conversation with Joyce Johnson, Dr. Joyce Johnson, Spelman organist and professor emerita of music. That's it for this edition of Closer Look. Programming note, NPR will have special news coverage in just a moment regarding former President Donald Trump. Our producers are LaShawn Hudson, Daniel Razel. Our supervising producer is Tiffany Griffin. Our engineer is Sawyer Vanderworth. Reminder, let us know your thoughts on today's program or any other. Send me an email, rose@wabe.org. And if you miss any of today's program, it's always online at wabe.org/closerlook. And of course, Closer Look weeknights at 7 p.m. as well as in our podcasts. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE, Atlanta.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you donated to WABE yet? I know you've heard us talking about why it's important, but it doesn't have to be this big decision. You can give at whatever amount fits your budget. It can be a spur-of-the-moment thing. You already get so much out of public radio, so just go for it. Visit wabe.org/donate and become a member right now. And thank you.